Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. Today I thought we'd talk a little bit about what's going on in Turkey. Austin, you wrote an article in On Point this week, and you talked a little bit about trees. And that was interesting to me because I hadn't seen that necessarily in some of the other reports. Can you tell us all about what trees have to do with what's going on in Turkey?
I also mentioned social media, Dan, and right. Trees and social media are one element of the evolving situation in Turkey. They're part of what ignited the situation, or at least brought a lot of complaints, expressions of disenchantment, disgust, and concern to the surface nationally. All right, I'll try to explain that. National government, Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan, we've talked about Prime Minister Erdogan many times on Strategy Talk. He's really emerged over the last few years as a major global figure, but he is also perceived correctly as being a very arrogant individual, very arbitrary in many of the decisions he makes, and at least half of the citizens of Turkey are concerned that his long-term goal is to undermine the secular nature of Turkish democracy, because his party, the Justice and Development Party, AKP, and I will often refer to it as the AKP, is a moderate Islamist party. Now, let me stress, Dan, it really is a moderate Islamist party. They are sworn enemies of Al-Qaeda, and they have practiced democratic politics. However, the question that lingers in the minds of many Turks now is one that has cropped up throughout the Arab Spring countries, Tunisia now as well, is the Islamists win an election. Is that the last time there's a party change in government? And the AKP has been in power and won the 2002 election. So it's been in power over a decade. Now, Erdogan, I told you, has a reputation for being arrogant and arbitrary. He's also a very sophisticated and slick and gifted politician. However, here he made a mistake. We're getting back to trees. Taksim Park is the center of what is Istanbul's most modern, vibrant entertainment district, Beyoğlu. It's it used to be the Greek and Genoan Italian quarter of Pera. Sometimes you'll still hear Beyoğlu referred to as Pera. It's across the Golden Horn from Istanbul, the where Hagia Sophia Museum and the old Sultan's Palace are located, and the Blue Mosque. But Taksim Square is the center of it. There's also a monument there to the Turkish Republic. And there is a small park. I must say, when I was in Taksim Square in the early 90s, I do not remember Gezi Park. I must have walked past it 8 or 9 times, Dan, but it's spelled in English, G-E-Z-I. And it is a wooded park there in the vicinity of Taksim Square. And the government announced that they were going to knock down the trees, and Gezi Park was part of a large-scale urban renewal project. Now, you might wonder, why would there be urban renewal in this modern place that also has a great deal of cultural significance? There were locals in the area that asked the same question. But as I understand the plan, they were going to erect a modern building that looked a lot like an Ottoman-era military barracks. I understand there's some of those within the close to Taksim Square now. The former Turkish War College that, I wrote about that in my book on Kemal Ataturk was located in the vicinity of Taksim Square. But they were going to erect this new building, and then to add insult to the injury, this was going to be turned into a multi-level shopping mall. And so you got not only the locals who didn't want to lose the trees, but wait a minute, why do we need this when we've got some of the finest shops in Turkey out here, and this is just going to kind of sit there? And there were some people, this has emerged, I've seen this mentioned, Dan, I can't speak for it. It was, they saw this as Erdogan overreach, and perhaps he really wanted to go after the monument to the Republic of Turkey, which dates from the 1920s, and it's a monument extolling the Republic of Turkey, which is largely the political product of Mustafa Kemal Ataturk. We'll get to Erdogan and his jealousy and envy of Mustafa Kemal Ataturk in a moment, but you tough to separate that from some of these issues as well. So, on May 26th, a group of locals in Istanbul, from what I can tell, most of them were from the Beyoğlu area themselves. Now, not all of them. I found this on the web, Dan, and listeners can go look it up. There's an announcement by a group in Istanbul, I believe they call themselves the Meditation Flash Mob, announcement saying, show up in Gezi Park this afternoon, we're going to have a flash mob. And you know how that's really kind of a social event, quasi-political, but it was social media. And people showed up on May 26th, and they said, we're protesting the destruction of these trees in this park, and, well, locals, and I'm going to tell you that the people that showed up there, from what I can tell, both my excellent source in Istanbul and what I've read in the Turkish press, this wasn't a typical tree-hugger group. This was a representative sample of the sophisticated neighborhoods in the area. And, of course, a number of kids from the flash mob. Peaceful protest. Went on. They gathered the next day. And then the next day. But here we come to May 30th, and that's when the police, according to the demonstrators, attacked the group. The police said that they had security concerns. And we all know how peaceful demonstrations like this are at risk always run the risk of violent extremists throwing rocks, committing arson. Hey, it happens here in the United States. It happens in Great Britain and France all the time. It happens in Japan. And here's Turkey, the reputation of the Turkish police and security forces is well deserved. But the police decided they were going to break up the demonstration. Demonstrators came back again on May 31st, angry, and the police tear gassed them and broke the demonstration up. And then right there, because all this was being covered, not just people tweeting, as typical social media, now the international press is out there, because the international press is fast and thick in Istanbul, and the Turkish press, even including the semi-official government news service. And there are these images of all of these typical Istanbulians, an entire range of folks, coughing, police, shoving them around, and like they're all over the country. And suddenly, it's a mass movement. I read this 2 days ago. We're recording this on June 6th. I wrote the column and did the interview with Imre Kizilkaya, and I'll talk about that and what Imre does in a moment, on June 4th. So it was 2 days ago. But I read a report at the time that said that in 67 or 68 of Turkey's 81 provinces, you'd had protests in sympathy to the demonstrators in Taksim Square, anger at police and security force overreaction. It's a similar incident in the capital in Ankara when a crowd gathered to in support of the Taksim Square demonstrators. So, Dan, I know one of the press themes that emerged is Turkish Spring. It's not Arab Spring. Turkey is a democracy. It has hideous flaws as a democracy, but it is a for real a democracy. I was interviewed by another podcast group, and I said it's a kind of a rebalancing is really what we're witnessing, because we can talk about some of the cultural or piety laws that the AKP has proposed and passed in the not-too-distant past. I mean, really, this spring, alcohol laws. I'll talk about that in just a second. But it's like, you know, you're attacking our lifestyles. You are undermining the secular nature of the secular core of Turkish democracy. And as Emre Kızılkaya said in the interview that was part of the On Point column, you know, a lot of this is now focused on the person and personality of Prime Minister Erdogan, his arrogance, arbitrariness, and shall I mention alcohol now? Beyoğlu has a long-term reputation of being a great party district. The Sultans were known to like their wine. Pressure from the culturally conservative components of the AKP on Prime Minister Erdogan, and the AKP's got a large majority in parliament. They passed and imposed restrictive measures on the public consumption of alcohol. Not the sales, but public consumption, no advertising and the like. Now, just as a vignette here, I saw this, a translation of it actually on Emre Kızılkaya's very fine blog, The Istanbulian. He translates an ad that was an advertisement by the Turkish Wine Merchants Association that points out that Anatolia's had a wine industry for 7,000 years. And this may be our last ad. We're sorry and we regret it. Now, of course, irony here is that probably in the first several thousand years of that wine industry, it was a Greek wine industry, but nevertheless, it was Anatolian, you know, and it was in what is now the modern Republic of Turkey. Turks like their rocky, like their wine. Ephesus, F.A.'s now, but it's the Ephesians of Paul's letter to the Ephesians, has got a fabulous German brewery, and they make Efes beer. And restrictions on that. It's regarded as something the Turks regard Efes as a signature product, and it is a good beer. Now, this is a small element of it, but it's like you pushed us too far. And here's the action in the street. Not all the people involved are from the Turkish secularists. Emre said at the demonstration he was at on June 4th, he saw the entire demographics of Turkey there at Taksim Square. He says young women in veils. They want to wear veils. And he said old soldiers who admire Ataturk. And that's your staunch Turkish secularists. So it'll be interesting to see how Prime Minister Erdogan handles himself and these demonstrations, since he happens to be returning to Turkey today. He's been out of the country for a while. The deputy prime minister has been dealing with all of the various protest groups. As a matter of fact, they have the protesters gave the deputy prime minister a list either on the 4th or 5th and said, we want you to fire the governors, super mayors of Istanbul and Ankara, and mentioned one other city as well, and their police chiefs, because of the overreaction and denial of civil rights. I don't know what the prospects are for meeting that demand. But the deputy prime minister says, we're very sorry. We regret the police overreaction. We're going to investigate it. And this is a mistake. But Erdogan, gifted rhetorician that he is, very smart and savvy politician, he returns today, and now the protests are about him. Last point is, the critical question, Dan, is will this outpouring of resentment and anger be reflected in the next national elections? I don't know.
Jim, how does this all play into what's going on in the region with Syria and like that, having the unrest inside of Turkey?
Well, the basic problem is the Turkish Empire never went away. Turks always complained about, you know, having to deal with all these people they conquered. They half joked, and I've had that Turks tell me this, you know, that a favorite saying is, they don't involve yourself with the affairs of the Arabs, but that the Turks were up to their necks in that for centuries, and now they can't get away with things like Syria. And, of course, Iran, who was their perennial enemy, you know, for over 500 years. The empire was supposed to have been, you know, fixed, as it were, you know, all the bad habits that the Turks had picked up in building their empire were to have been fixed by Ataturk, who was an impressive guy, and a very bold leader, and he enacted a lot of reforms. He shook things up, but he didn't change all of the Turks. You know, as Austin has mentioned in his frequent coverage of, you know, the Balkans and Turkey, go outside of the cities, and it's a different Turkey. It's old Turkey. And Erdogan basically depends upon old Turkey, which is still very Islamic. Indeed, I've spoken to Air Force people over the years who have served at the it was Incirlik Air Base in central eastern Turkey. It's in the middle of Erdogan territory. I mean, they're still very Islamic out there, old-fashioned. And the Air Force guys serving there complained that you couldn't get a drink, even though it was legal, and you don't dare go near the women, even though some of them, you know, will give you a wink and what have you, because, you know, you can start a riot. And the Air Force, that was the thing. They had the control over decades, and, of course, they're still there. Is, for God's sake, don't start anything with the locals. You know, it's not just offensive to them. If they are Turks, and they can get extremely nasty. Erdogan basically took advantage of the, or capitalized on the discontent, not only of the rural Turks, who were basically upset at the fact that the city slicker Turks were corrupt, which they had been throughout the imperial period, which ended in 1918, and basically held themselves above the law, which, because of the corruption, they were. And, you know, a few people were making a lot of money and doing it at the expense of, you know, your average Turk out in the country, you know, paid his taxes, basically didn't have too much to be corrupt with or about. And that's why he got elected, because the corruption has been a growing problem. Indeed, it came to a head when, after the Cold War ended in 1991, and the Turks were basically, you know, delirious along with everybody else in NATO, and they pointed out that, look, we have been faithful NATO allies, members for decades. We were basically holding the right flank against the Soviet hordes, and we've been basically trying to get into the European Union. How about our reward? Well, they didn't get it. This was very unpopular in Turkey. They said, what do we have to do? You know, we're modern. We use their damn alphabet. We have a lot of their institutions. But as the EU pointed out, they said, look, you're hopelessly corrupt. You've got a big economy, but it's a mess because of the corruption. And then they had insult to injury. You know, Greece got in and got into the Eurozone by fixing the very same problem. The Greeks fixed their corruption. At least they said they did. As we know now, it was all, you know, smoke mirrors and a fresh coat of paint. But the Turks were basically feeling discriminated against. And Erdogan basically took advantage of that backlash, the general and growing unpopularity of things as they always have been done since 1918 with the corruption, and he came in and he fixed the corruption. He basically made it, and this was important for the economy because the economy has grown since him and his party have been in power. He made it easier for entrepreneurs to basically get started, grow a business, and not be basically, you know, cut down by some big shot who's got a cronies in the government and can shut down any potential competition just by, you know, spreading some money around. And this made him extremely popular. But as Austin points out, they are moderate Islamists, but they are still, you know, pro-Islam. And this is anathema to secular Turks who have basically been in charge, you know, since the 1920s. And these, you know, Muslims, as it were, you know, practicing Muslims, they wanted their, you know, kind of flesh is the right word, but they wanted their due. And Erdogan gave it to them, you know, basically started enacting laws. But as Austin pointed out, where Erdogan went, you know, and reformed too far was he started turning Turkey back into the empire, a police state, which is kind of ironic because that was where things started to go wrong. I mean, not that Turkey was ever a democracy. They were not. They started out as a tribal confederation. It took them a while, you know, to adopt Islam. But they basically were, the Turks in general, have been very good at adapting, like the Japanese, who they're distantly related to, actually. They were very adaptive, and they basically looked around them and said, well, let's take some of this, let's take some of that, what have you. But one of the things they took from the Greeks was a culture of corruption. You know, not to beat on the Greeks, but basically even the Romans said, those damn Greeks, you know, they got a lot of culture, but my God, count your fingers after you shake your hands. And, you know, they're infamous for that. Even during the period of Alexander the Great, it was mentioned. You know, the amount of money you expected. They plundered the Persian Empire, and when the Greeks did the books, they basically had a subsection for corruption, for money that was basically stolen by generals and what have you. So the Turks adapted bad habits as well as good ones. And they wanted basically to have prosperity and freedom, all the good things in life. But Erdogan, he got obsessed with this idea of let's be pious Muslims and let's rebuild, you know, Turkey as it was during its greatest period, you know, basically during the 18th century, 19th century. And most Turks don't want that. Plus, as Austin pointed out, a lot of Turks are basically saying, no, wait a minute. You know, we love you for the good things you've done, but now you're getting a little creepy. And this is what's coming out. Now, Erdogan makes a big thing about he got reelected last, the recent election, but it was close. And if you look at the trends, which Erdogan, you know, doesn't want you to pay too much attention to, his margin of victory has been getting narrower and narrower and narrower, and he's basically losing in the polls. Now, he basically believes in himself, and that's always a big mistake. You don't believe your own press releases. That's the first step down the road to destruction. And this is only going to get worse because he is not into making compromises. At least he hasn't given any evidence of that. You know, he's out there basically blaming, you know, the social media, blaming the effete, you know, urban snobs, whatever they have some very colorful, you know, Turkish words for it. He's not basically admitting, look, we got a problem here, let's solve it. And that's just making the opposition even more upset because they said, well, hey, we can't even bargain with this guy. So it's liable to get uglier before it gets better.
Well, Austin, when are the elections again there in Turkey?
You know, I'm not sure about what the next when the next elections are, the national elections for parliament. But, you know, Dan, it's pretty easy to look it up, national elections. Let's see if it's what I've got here.
What they also have to worry about is whether Erdogan will not try and change the rules to make elections illegal in the future. or any elections that might, you know, not go his way.
Well, look, this is one of the issues, really, is some of the constitutional changes that he's proposed. He wants to change some of the ways that the authority of the Constitutional Court, that's seen as an attack on a safeguard. He says, well, it still has all these old corrupt secularists running it. Yes, no, maybe. He also wants to create a strong presidency, and the idea is he's going to create this strong presidency, and since he's in a position, I believe he can't succeed himself as prime minister again. He's going to run for president, and essentially the presidency will have the powers of the prime minister. And that's self-serving. That is a self. Well, yeah, it is. But the thing is that that's a bit unfair, Jim, because the thing is Putin's operating within a genuinely authoritarian system and coercive intimidation, the other way. But it has elements of it.
But that's the direction Erdogan is going.
Exactly.
Taking over the media. Basically using his power to basically punish any opposition. I mean, he isn't as brutal as Putin. I'll give him that.
No, he's not. But what I'm saying is that Russia's systemic situation is different than Turkey. You do have the common factor here of gifted, autocratic, driven, power-hungry politicians. And Erdogan certainly fits in that mold as Putin, and he is molding the Turkish political system to meet his own personal political objectives. That's one of the things that has come out in the demonstrations, Dan, is the anger with Putin's autocratic streak and his what they perceive as this slow motion power grab that is essentially usurping democratic checks and balances and undermining the democratic process. And it's not just that he's doing it because he's a pious cultural Islamist. He's also Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and he's building his own legacy as a very, very powerful man. When I said that he was jealous of Ataturk, he truly is jealous of him as a visionary, as a political leader. At the same time, he has respect for the extraordinary success of Ataturk had in establishing modern Turkey. But there's even a slight at Ataturk that figures into the current demonstrations. When the alcohol laws were passed, and I've gotten this from two sources. One is in Der Spiegel, the German magazine, and then another is a Turkish newspaper. But he said, "Hey, we're just changing laws that were put in place by two drunks." And Ataturk was an alcoholic, and his chief lieutenant, who succeeded him as president, Ismet İnönü, who was a superb field officer himself in the Turkish Nationalist Army, he was presumed to be the second drunk that Erdogan was referring to when he made that glib comment. It got a lot of reaction in Turkey. 10, 12 days, people mulling on this. Even some of his culturally conservative supporters in the AKP, Erdogan supporters, thought it was a cheap shot at a great Turkish leader. All right, he was an alcoholic, but he and Inanu were not drunks. They were World War I heroes. They were heroes in the Turkish War for Independence, Greco-Turk War is another name for that, and they were both key leaders in the shaping the process that's created modern Turkey. Now, let me make a comment on something Jim said about Erdogan's economic success. That's for real. He gets blistered by some social democrats in Turkey, and there's social democrats in his party and even in the Republican People's Party, which is the Kemalist or secular party, because they say, well, he's a neoliberal, like quote-unquote Margaret Thatcher. Well, no, he's not Margaret Thatcher, but he understands, as Jim said, he's opened the economy up for entrepreneurial creativity, and it's reaped some rewards. There are issues about corruption in the AKP that tag it. They're very real. Issues about cronyism around Erdogan himself. But the thing is, he did make some of the changes to deal with the corruption issue, and that Jim pointed out, it's had immense economic benefits. There are a lot of people that have voted for Erdogan because they see the positive things they've done, and he really is a brilliant, skilled politician. He's a tough debater. He's fast on his feet. He's witty. He's an excellent rhetorician. But the thing is, he's gone too far. And the interview in the column that I did, Imre Kizilkaya, Imre is an international news editor for one of Turkey's largest newspapers, Hürriyet. And there's a lot of the interview that didn't make it into the column, but a part that did was when Imre says, look, Turkey was held up as a model to Arab Spring revolutionaries. Take a look. Here's a culturally Islamic society that has a modern economy with some issues, but modern economy, and has a successful democracy with a lot of hideous flaws, but every democracy has flaws. Take a look at it. And Erdogan, to his credit, in September of 2011, he goes to Egypt, he goes to Libya, he goes to Tunisia, and on major television shows, popular television shows in all of those countries, in other words, probably in Libya, half the people in the country saw it, a large portion of the Egyptian population saw him as well. He said, look, I am a Muslim. I'm a faithful Muslim, but I'm also the leader of a secular democracy. I encourage all of you to stick to secular democratic principles. He said that in September of 2011, and I've got a couple of on-point columns from that time that mention this and mention the significance of what he was doing internationally. But it's come back to him, as Imre Kizilkaya says in the interview. It's like, hey, Mr. Erdogan, you say that this is what these Arab revolutionary states should be doing? Well, you live up to your own rhetoric. And the trees, Dan, were a last straw. The alcohol restrictions, a last straw. Erdogan has had a number of last straws. But then, as I said a moment ago, first part of the interview, is this going to translate into the next national election? The last national election was 2011. I'm going to say, venture that the next
2 years. It's 26.
It's when? It's 2 years?
2 years, yeah.
All right, 3 years have been. Okay. Jim looked. So that's the big issue in Turkey.
Jim, to wrap this up, how are events that are happening in Turkey, how could they affect what's going on in Syria?
Well, it's not good for the Syrians, because the Turks are an essential part of the decision-making, cabal that in NATO that has to decide, will NATO do anything? Syria has gone critical right now because Iran has basically gone all in. They convinced Hezbollah to openly declare, that they are backing Assad and they are basically at war, with the rebels in Syria. Now, we ran a piece today on that, on Syria, and we explained how this does not, automatically doom the rebels, because Hezbollah has other things to worry about, like another Lebanese civil war. They haven't got that large of a military force, actually. 10,000 people they can move around, another 30,000-40,000 that will defend their neighborhoods, as it were, back in Lebanon. The Iranians, though, are paying for the Hezbollah mobilization. People are getting paid. That's always a big incentive. They have basically made possible a 50% pay increase for the lower-ranking troops in the Syrian army. And they're basically keeping the Assad, you know, government alive. Now, somebody has to do something. And what's being brought up does involve Turkey in that a lot of Europeans are saying, look, didn't we go through this 20 years ago in the Balkans? You know, didn't we basically stand by wringing our hands while 200,000 people got killed in Bosnia because we wouldn't intervene? And they eventually did intervene and stop the killing. And, of course, we intervened even more quickly in 1999 in Kosovo and, you know, stopped that. There were dead bodies before, you know, NATO got mobilized. But again, the problem is, as the opponents to intervention point out, yes, we did it in Libya, but no good deed goes unpunished when you're dealing with the Arabs or the Muslims. You know, people don't want to pay for it. They don't want to take the heat from, you know, the people, the Muslims and whatever who will criticize them. The Turks in particular didn't want to be accused of trying to reestablish the Turkish Empire, although internally that's where Erdogan is taking it. So all this tumult inside of Turkey means Turkey, you know, Erdogan and the rest of the leadership really can't pay too much attention to Syria. And NATO really can't, you know, do anything without Turkey saying, okay. So it hurts the rebels, it helps the Assad, and God help us all if that becomes critical.
Just wanted to say Jim's read on that is dead on. This is a respite for Assad and a boon to the Iranians. At the same time, in the long run, Turkey, as a functioning secular democratic state in a culturally Islamic society, is a threat that Iran. That is what is going to knock the Khomeinis and the Iranian Ayatollahs down and send them to the dustbin of history. They're fighting a long-term rearguard action. So Jim said Syria is going critical. Let's see how Turkey responds and what the situation is 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 months, because I didn't broach this early on because it has something of a conspiratorial flavor to it. But let's just suggest it as a scenario. Erdogan, national leader, situation in Syria. No, it's not popular with the Turks to intervene in Syria, but mass murder in Syria is not popular with the Turks either. And the one thing is that Turks, when the Syrian military has violated the border, which they have, and they caught a Syrian agent that was the Turks are charging the Syrian agent with involvement in the car bombings that went off in the little Turkish border town. There are ways I could see Erdogan saying, okay, I must be the national leader, and, you know, I'm not saying go to a border war, but he's got a border situation where he can shine as a leader. That's just not saying that's going to happen. But that is a political scenario, and it dovetails in with addressing the situation in Syria. And by the way, Jim is right. The page that I was on, I looked at, it's 2014. That's when Erdogan's 7 years as prime minister is up, because he was elected prime minister in 2007.
Okay. Well, we'll leave it there, and we'll talk to you gentlemen next time.
Take care, Dan. Mm-hmm. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.